So the way that Wagner uses these leitmotifs, these themes in Parsifal, is not cut and dried, is it? It's not not representative of a spear, a sword, or anything like that. These are very vague.
Well, if you've tried to read more than one book on Wagner, you'll probably find that the motives have different names according to who you're reading. And I think there's no opera of Wagner's in which the meaning of the motifs is more fluid than in this opera. You know, it changes definitely, depending on context. And sometimes they're more like symbols in a dream that leave you wondering what they mean. It's almost the ambiguity is the real key. And by the end of Parsifal, as these motifs swim around in this beautiful polyphonic texture, it's much more like the coming together of themes at the end of a symphony than at the end of an opera.
Yes.
So I think it's part of the beauty of the use of leitmotifs in this opera is that they are so ambiguous. But they're not like Debussy. Debussy said that when he went to the Ring, he felt like every time he heard a motif, he felt like raising his hat and saying, hello, spear motif, hello, fate motif. It's much subtler than that in Parsifal. Yeah. He's gone a tremendous way from that, I think, as he does in Pass of the Ring, of course.
Indeed. Yes. And it being his dying piece, as it were, he died in Venice the next year after its performance, it was given that it should never be performed outside Bayreuth, that maybe it would be Bayreuth's cash cow, so the copyright was not allowed elsewhere.
They did,
Metropolitan Opera discovered that, that the writ didn't apply to them, so they performed it. But it wasn't until, I think, 1914 that they eventually let, and this is just an example of how extraordinary the appetite for Wagner was back then, as it still is today. One of the countries, I think it was Spain, it was about sort of 10:30 or something, happened to be midnight on 1914, because they were a little bit earlier than Germany, and they started. And between January the 1st and June the 1st, there were 50 different performances of Parsifal around the world. The appetite for this work was absolutely enormous.
Can I take you back, Stephen, just to, you mentioned that the hero, the anti-hero, whatever, of Parsifal is der reine Tor, the pure fool. He's also the outsider. And isn't always, pretty much always, the hero of a Wagner piece, the outsider? Is this Wagner himself, his feeling of being an outsider?
I think there's a great deal of truth in that. Though, I mean, Wagner sometimes had moments of extraordinary honesty in his writing where he saw himself in parts you would never imagine. It's common amongst some to believe that Mima in The Ring is considered an anti-Semitic stereotype. And Cosima noted that Wagner had said to her, that's Cosima, his wife, my lord, I just realized I am Mima. So I think he saw parts of himself in all the characters. But yes, I mean, he liked the idea, I think, of what art could do. And the real point is that art could replace religion, and that the symbolism of art, writers like Fraser in The Golden Bowl were beginning to discover this, that the symbolism and the rituals of religion were attempting to give humans some kind of relief from their suffering, some kind of belief in themselves, some kind of sense of their place and use in the universe. And Wagner didn't believe any single religion could do this, but he did believe that art could. And that's why he had such an incredible thirst for philosophy and for theology and for Eastern theology and other things, because he wanted to combine them all to find ways of showing that these rituals, so the rituals in the Grail, he's not really the cup into which Christ's blood ran, the spear isn't really the spear. They're all, as you could call them, symbols of certain aspects of humanity, if you liked.
Stephen Johnson, you were saying earlier how important ritual is in this piece, in the music of this piece, and you wanted us to hear the end of the first act for this.
Oh, yes, because I think this sets up three important motifs that, if you don't know the opera, might be helpful for you. The first of all is one sung to a set of words, durch Mitleid wissend der reine Tor, through compassion made wise the pure fool. This is sung by an alto solo high up in the gods at the end of Act One. Then we hear on the chorus a beautiful figure called the Dresden Amen, which is not actually by Wagner. It's an old Amen, a Lutheran Amen, that Wagner had heard during his days when he was Kapellmeister at the court of Dresden, and he uses, or transfigures in this piece. And then finally, we hear the sound of those bells and that rotating circular sound. We've just watched a kind of highly Wagnerized magical version of the Mass, haven't we? And now, as the act comes to the end, this circular movement on the bells brings us to that sense of timelessness, the timelessness of the rite and the timelessness of the drama again.
Let's hear that.
That's worth the entrance money alone, isn't it? Yeah.
Just one thing that's worth, tiny little musical detail, I just noticed, that sounds like an organ there, doesn't it, at the end? It's not. It's a fantastically scored wind chord. Wagner has such mastery of the orchestra at this stage, he can achieve just about any effect he wants with the members of the Standard Symphony Orchestra. That extraordinary sound. I was just looking at that chord before we came on and going, wow, that's scoring.
Well, that's the end of Act One. Act Two is much more sensual, you might say Tristan-esque, the exotic world, as you were saying, Stephen Fry, of the Outcast Knight Klings or the Flower Maidens. It's more sensual, it's more dramatic. There's much more of a sense of action in Act Two.
There is, yeah. Before that marvellous moment we've just heard, poor old Percy has been kicked out of the Monsalvat, the name of the Grail monastery, for being an idiot because he didn't seem to understand any of the gesture and the rituals. And so he finds himself in the Klingsor's magic garden. And Kundry has transformed herself into this utterly beautiful maiden. And Klingsor addresses her by various names, Herodias, various names back from history. She's ancient, she's timeless herself. So she's no longer the wild woman Kundry, she's now this extremely beautiful woman. And Klingsor is determined that this Parsifal figure, who frightens him somehow, must be corrupted, must be seduced. And the beautiful flower maidens sing to him, and then there's this, as you say, this magnificent moment when Kundry herself turns it on and he's going to kiss her, and he holds back and thinks of Amfortas.
This is an extraordinary moment, though, because it's the first time in the opera, after at least 2 hours of music, that we actually hear the name Parsifal.
Yes.
And it's when she calls it out, Parsifal, and he stands stock still and comes up with this extraordinary line, "I think my mother once called me that in a dream." Yeah. And this is such an important turning point, isn't it?
It is.
Really is.
Here it is. I think one thing we are proving is that the music does it. We don't actually need any of the rest.
But no, it is one of the... Well, I think it's probably the opera that most... has least taken away from it, from having a no sets, just orchestral.
Stephen Johnson, can I just turn to you and talk a bit about Kundry herself? I mean, she and Parsifal are the two characters who make very different journeys. As Stephen Fry was saying, we've seen her in Act One as wild, half mad. Now she's the beautiful temptress, and in Act Three she'll become a kind of Mary Magdalene like penitent. She seems immortal. She seems anguished to be immortal in these three incarnations. Wagner invented her character. She's a sort of compilation from the sources. Is she the glue sticking the plot together?
Well, there's a fascinating thing about Wagner's heroes and heroines is that they're transgender. in a lot of Wagner's earlier operas, there's an innocent redeemer figure, and she's almost always a woman. But then in the last opera, it becomes male, it becomes Parsifal. Wagner was also fascinated, considering that he was an anti-Semite, this is rather striking, by the figure of the wandering Jew, an archetypal figure from legend, the Jew who cursed or laughed at Christ on the cross and was sentenced to wander eternally. The Flying Dutchman is a version of the wandering Jew. And this figure turns up, and he's usually male in Wagner's operas, but in the last opera, he becomes female, he becomes Kundry. At the same time, she's clearly standing in for Mother in this act. Like most of Wagner's male heroes, Parsifal is an orphan. He doesn't even really know much about his parents. And so Kundry comes on. She gives him his name, the classic mother thing. So my mother once called me in a dream. She awakens his curiosity about his mother. She tells him that his mother loved him and that she cared for him. And then she kisses him, and it's this one, we're on the cusp of Freud here, that the mother's eroticism is what awakens the eroticism in the child. But he then has to reject the mother, which is what happens in the course of it. He turns, it seems rather cruelly in context. And yet if you're thinking about this as a kind of maturation process that's going on, which will end with Parsifal being initiated into a male society at the end of the opera, that also makes sense. I mean, the thing is, there are so many different strands in this opera that you could possibly pick out. Yes.
The kiss is the light bulb moment.
The kiss is the climax of the opera. It's the central climax of the opera. It's the moment that just suddenly, that's it. Schopenhauer was fascinated by the fact that long before Freud, that eroticism and sublimated eroticism was at the heart of so many of our urges and instincts. And that really spoke to Wagner. And so the idea of the kiss, this is what awakens him. But, you know, I remember thinking after I heard it for the first time, if Parsifal had just rejected her at that moment, it would be a piece of ghastly, unforgivable Puritanism. But because it's through this moment of his awakening, he understands why Amfortas fell. He was tempted by desire. He feels the pain because desire is pain. Yes. It's a tremendously complicated moment. And yet at the same time, the music just makes it happen. You're not, you can sit afterwards doing what I'm doing and thinking about the ramifications of it. And yet in the moment, it's just, it's a light bulb moment, as you say.
Mm. So Parsifal catches the spear.
Mm-hmm. The spear. Yes, Klingsor throws the spear, which he now has. The Brotherhood of the Grail should look after both the Grail and the spear as the holy relics. But they lost the spear because of Amfortas's desire, and he was wounded by it, and Klingsor kept it. And Klingsor throws it, and in various productions, I've actually seen it work, he throws it at Parsifal, and it stops midair in front of him. Parsifal takes it. It's an extraordinary moment.
And the kingdom disappears.
And the kingdom crumbles into nothingness.
And Parsifal wanders for years and eventually finds himself back.
Yes, that's the strange thing, is the time gap. Yeah,
this is where, as well, the Buddhist idea of non-violence, ahimsa, becomes very important. Parsifal uses violence when he's still innocent. Mm. To fight his way into Klingsor's castle. After he's become wise, he doesn't use violence anymore. It's a non-violent act that results in the destruction of Klingsor's castle.
You could call Siegfried a kind of precursor, couldn't
it? It is, you could. But also, when Parsifal arrives eventually after his wanderings in Act 3, it turns out that he is wounded because he's been unable to use the spear in his self-defense, because that's not what it's for. And this is where you get to the things where you can see Goebbels scratching his head and saying, well, that's not what we want
at all.
You know, hardly. All this compassion and non-violence. This is why Wagner is so incredibly complicated, really.
It's true.
And the music in Act Three, is it a joining up of the music from Act One and Act Two? I mean, we've got this incredibly beautiful Good Friday music.
Well, it is the most symphonic opera of all in proportions. You could actually see it as a big three-movement symphony with two very big, spacious, slow movements framing a much more active yes. central movement. And the key scheme bears this out. And the recapitulation, gradually, of ideas in Act Three is phased almost like the return of ideas at the end of a cyclical symphony. Yes. And indeed, as you get to the end of the opera, and everything just dissolves in this beautiful, ecstatic counterpoint. It's got the serenest, quietest end, I think, of any Wagner opera.
Absolutely, and you should remember that, I mean, the Montsalvat was in a bad enough state with Amfortas wounded yes. when we first meet it, but by the time we come back to it at Act Three, it's dying.
It's disintegrated.
All old. Yes. Titurel, the father of Amfortas, has died,
yes.
and it is an absolute... It's the arrival suddenly back with Parsifal, with the spear, is the new king knight, and it's the full replenishment of the order. But before, as they all kneel solemnly and they're going to open the grail and it's all going to be marvellous, he says, for me, a very touching moment, he says, mein erstes Amst, my first duty, my first task, he baptises Kundry. It's a very, very touching moment. And then, in one of those inexplicable Wagnerian moments, as with Hundig, she then just... dies, but the baptism is setting her free and yeah. slightly less mad than the moment in Die Valkyrie where it's gay, and, no. and then Hundig falls down dead.
Before we talk about whether this piece is Christian, Buddhist, what it is, let's just hear the end of the opera. Wow.
Yes.
It's very difficult to say anything after that, actually. I mean, I was just going to read this little quote from Wieland Wagner, the director, grandson of Wagner, who said that for most people, Parsifal remains a Christian mystery play. And I was going to ask you whether that was true. And having heard that music, I feel I don't want to ask that question at all, really. But, you know, we've talked about it. It's full of Christian ritual, or ritual of a kind, and
yes.
it's full of sexual guilt. What, apart from the music per se, does this piece offer us now?
I think, like all great art, it addresses the issues of guilt, passion, desire, suffering, pain, death, worry, companionship, all the things that we don't really understand, things we know that are somehow the curse and the blessing of being alive. And through his syncretic use of different religions and different philosophies, he has created his own legendary world that, yes, uses certainly Arthurian legend as its absolute basis, but draws in many other things too, to teach us essentially that simple thing. It ends with that moment we heard. It sounds preposterous. It ends with a dove on above the head of Parsifal. If it's done well, it just absolutely has you in tears. And it is, for all the monstrosity of the man, his music and his art was on the side of the angels. And I think this piece, perhaps more than any of his other works, proves that.
I recently reread another work that's had an enormous effect on me, Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov. And I was fascinated by this because Dostoevsky wrote that book with a very clear intention in mind, and that was to vindicate Russian Orthodox Christianity and show that it could offer redemption to the modern world, as is contemporary with Parsifal, more or less. But as Dostoevsky himself admitted, although Alyosha Karamazov is the embodiment of his ideal, all the brothers are Dostoevsky, and that includes Ivan the despairing atheist. And Dostoevsky said that the conversations between Ivan and Alyosha, he wasn't sure whether in some cases Ivan didn't win. And it's very easy to believe that, particularly because of the way some Wagnerites talk, that Wagner himself is this great philosophical monolith with everything worked out and integrated and consistent. But I think that, you know, actually Wagner the man is riven with contradictions. And there are moments when, yes, as you beautifully said, Mima or Alberich may have been set up as an anti-Semitic caricature, but Wagner himself said that he felt tremendous compassion for Alberich and that the outrage at the robbing of the gold from Alberich is a great turning point in Das Rheingold. So there are these moments when something much higher than Wagner's ideology speaks through Wagner's art, and that is Wagner the artist rather than Wagner the thinker. And Wagner the artist is, I do believe, incomparably greater than Wagner the thinker, however impressive Wagner the thinker is.
That, I'm afraid, is all we've time for. For now, please thank my guests this afternoon, Stephen Fry and Stephen Johnson.
That was absolutely fascinating, wasn't it? Martin Handley, joined at the Royal College of Music there by Stephen Fry and Stephen Johnson for that Proms Plus event recorded earlier this evening, which was produced by Janet Tupper. Now, there's a Proms Plus event before every concert this season, so if you are heading for a prom here, do check online or in the Proms Guide to find out where and when it's happening. And if you'd like to find out more still about Wagner's Parsifal, it's amongst the BBC Radio 3 opera guides that you can find online from the Radio 3 homepage. If you look under Opera on 3, there's all kinds of insights there from experts, musicologists, singers and conductors. And don't forget that this performance of Parsifal will be available online via the BBC iPlayer radio. You're listening to BBC Radio 3, home of the Proms. I'm Andrew McGregor, live here at the Royal Albert Hall. And if you've managed to get tickets or to promenade for any of the Wagner operas here this season, you'll know that the singers aren't just standing and delivering. There's acting going on as well. And that means that somewhere in the background, there has to be a stage director. There is, and I'm delighted he's able to join me here in the box right now, Justin Way. Now, you've directed all but one of these Proms Wagner operas with no stage to speak of, no sets, no costumes, no stage hands to assist you. This must be utterly different.
But say no rehearsals as well. Yeah, of course it is. It's what an opportunity to have to encounter these conductors and these singers who are doing it. So, you know, I mean, it's very much a logistical responsibility. It's just a question of setting up the singers that they can, in concert form, sort of encounter each other and present as much of the story as possible, as much that they feel comfortable with, encourage their physical expressivity as much as their, you know, musical textual, put it all together to sort of, you know, to take the stops off where you can and just encourage them to go out there and really sell it.
So plenty of sensitive choreography, if you like, but no sort of rushing and leaping about, no props, no swords.
Oh, I would love to say lots of sensitive choreography. Well, it's no, of course not. I mean, there's really next to no time to actually. I mean, at no point do I have a session with the singers to take them through what we're going to do. It really is a question of as much communication as one can have with them in the orchestral rehearsals, in written form, sitting in the cafe, visiting their dressing rooms, sort of setting up as much as possible what, you know, the capabilities are in the space here. We've got some different entrances we can use. We've got 5 different entrances, so we can say that the Castle of the Grail's over there and the lake and the Holy Bath is down there and, you know, Araby is up that flight of stairs and set them off to tell the story based on some sense of a real location and interacting
with
one another.
So you've got some nice scenic consistency going on as well, which isn't just obvious to the the audience here in the hall. If our sound engineers are doing their job properly, as they always do, then you'll hear the same thing happening at home as well. You've also got control over the lighting.
Yeah.
But you can't really go for the sort of massive effects of a ray of light illuminating the channel.
I also think that would be incredibly inappropriate. You know, the lighting in such an event has to support the narrative, support the score. The last thing, you know, if an audience member is sitting there thinking about the lighting, you know, we've failed. However, we can use it to support the events of the story. I mean, we had great fun doing the end of the world in Valkyrie, of course, and the end of Goethe Dämmerung too. We kind of set the Albert Hall on fire, and it's very rarely that a director gets offered the opportunity to do such a thing.
So you can get away with quite a lot, just as long as the orchestra can still see the music.
Well, yeah, luckily for me, I think there's some kind of default switch here, which will not allow the orchestra lights to go below a certain level, so I don't have to worry about that.
Now, most of these things, they're obviously experienced Wagnerians most, and they know the roles backwards. So is it actually sometimes a case of just bringing it together as a whole and making sure that we don't have different singers' memories of 10 fully staged but very different concepts of Parsifal sort of jostling for supremacy?
Yes, I suppose so. But not that there's any time to sort of unwind or sort of re-record what people already have in there. It's really more setting a very logical set of parameters for what we can do in here that they can feel free to improvise, and they are improvising. You know, we've given them a set of points to hit, say, you know, if there's a big scene with a lot of people in it, we've established where people are going to be so that, you know, what can happen without anyone being afraid to bang into each other or, you know, tell the wrong story, essentially. Mm. So we just troubleshoot those moments, and Mr. Wagner kind of does the rest.
And would you say that you've been able to establish something of a house style for these for these Wagner props?
In the experience of six Wagners?
Yeah.
Well, you know, of course, there's been a little voice inside my head that has said, oh, you've got to do this one slightly differently. I did it. I mean, with the Ring, I was figuring out what to do because I'd never done a show in here before. So in the Ring, it was sort of seeing the capabilities of the lighting and, you know, how much of the house could see such and such a thing, whether such and such an effect would sort of work. And yes, I've been able to refine a little bit. When we did Tannhäuser, we had a lot less performing space. We had just a sort of, you know, a sort of meter or so across the front. So that was a very different mise en espace, as we call it, obviously, from what we had for the Ring or what we're having this evening for Tannhäuser, where, you know, we've got a good 2 or 3 meters there, and so lots of potential for storytelling.
Yeah, you've got generous space at the front of the stage for Parsifal, haven't you? It's not bad at all. But
We pushed for that.
After 6 Wagner operas in pretty rapid succession, how long do you think it's going to be before you can face another one?
I'm going to do a lot of Strauss this season at Covent Garden. I'm letting myself down easily.
I wouldn't say Elektra was an easy letter.
No, but by the time I get to Ariadne auf Naxos, it'll be like a holiday. Good question. Having done all these pieces in such a short amount of time, I mean, the Ring I've done, I worked on the recent Ring cycle at Covent Garden, I've done all those pieces, I've worked on them as an assistant. Tannhäuser I'd never done. So to be able to look at this man's work, you know, from 1845 to 1882, in the space of 6 weeks or whatever it's been, perhaps it's been less, 4 weeks, has been incredibly enriching, and I suppose I feel now more, can I say, comfortable with going into his world. You know, it's a very, very specific world dramaturgically, and, you know, one needs to approach it thoroughly, let's say.
Well, it's given you a wonderful opportunity to do that, and so many of us here feel so much more immersed in Wagner now. Well, Justin Wade, stage director for these Wagner proms and for Parsifal tonight, thank you very much for talking to us. You better get backstage and make sure everybody's in place and comfortable with the second act. And this evening's conductor, Sir Mark Elder, was talking to me yesterday about the complexity of bringing all the elements of Parsifal together here in the Albert Hall with so little time in the building itself, just as Justin's been experiencing it after having a week of rehearsals at home in Manchester with the Halle. A great deal of trust is needed, he was saying. And the experience of performing and recording so much Wagner with the Halle in the last few years has been invaluable, and not just for playing Wagner.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to program Wagner in the years that I'm with them, because if they are to play Debussy, for instance, they should know what Debussy's generation had in their memories. They should know all those Wagnerian works that came as a result of what Wagner did. To understand them fully, you have to know Wagner. But there's another reason as well, which is more the craft of being an orchestra. In order for Wagner to sound as mellow and as transparent as I hope that he can, it's very good for a symphony orchestra to play his music, because it won't sound well until everybody treats it as very large-scale chamber music. And so that everybody is hanging off, you know, their ears are really wide open in order to judge what the harmony is. And when I first became associated with the Halle, we did immediately some Wagner. We did an evening with Jane Eaglin, I remember, and we did the immolation scene, and then we did the first act of Tristan with Caterina de Lyman. And then I thought, we've got to do this more, we've got to do this regularly, because it is a wonderful way to develop their skills as an orchestra and as a group of musicians working together. It improves their sound, their sense of sonority. It stretches everybody. You know that the parts for the second and third clarinet are larger than the first clarinet. The second and third oboe have very big responsibilities, as if he was keeping the first players in reserve so that he didn't tire them. He shares out the honours. Same with the horns. And it stretches everybody. Everybody has a part to play that they have to really focus on and give themselves to completely. And it's been very exciting for me to watch the orchestra, individually and as a group, realise what great music this is and how it takes time to learn. Parsifal, for instance, we did very unusually. In June, I just had a day on the second act, because the second act is very different from the first and third. It's angular, it's the dirty bit, you know. So we started on that, and then we had a gap. And then in the middle of July, we did six rehearsals together in one lot, did the whole piece. Then we had a month off, and they all had a holiday. And then we came back this week, and we've spent the week, you know, honing it and reflecting on it and trying things and just making it more and more expressive and beautiful. And it's taxing for them. But the jokes about how long Wagner is are sort of starting to be forgotten. They just accept it now. And they know that a long haul is part of the challenge, but the rewards are enormous.
Aren't they just? But what about the musical language of Parsifal itself? How much has changed since Wagner's Ring Cycle by the time he reached his final opera?
By the time he came to Parsifal, his whole attitude towards how he should construct the fabric of the music was much more consciously symphonic. The musical material is, to all intents and purposes, all derived from the long, slow, arching melody that you hear at the work's opening. This unison melody. It contains the germs of all the musical material that you're going to hear, which is an extraordinary, imaginative leap for him to start this work with a monody, that is to say, one line without harmony, where the rhythm and the harmonic implication of the melody is up for grabs. And then he repeats it and embroiders it and starts to develop it as a great symphonic composer. And I think that at the end of his life, he was capable of this thematic metamorphosis in his last opera that really is extraordinary. There's scarcely a bar that doesn't relate to that opening melody. Of course, it doesn't sound like that. It sounds full of variety, and there are different tempi and different pitches and all the hallmarks of the great operatic composer.
Conductor Sir Mark Elder, and at the start of the second act of Parsifal, we're in Klingsor's magic castle, surrounded by his implements of witchcraft and necromancy. Klingsor knows the naive young man we've met in the first act is on his way, drawn to the castle, and he summons Kundry, his Rose of Hell, he calls her, his primeval witch. Klingsor already suspects that the fool on his way to the castle is more dangerous to him than any of the all-too-easily-seduced Grail Knights, and he orders Kundry to use her wiles on him. Parsifal, meanwhile, has climbed the tower of Klingsor's castle and sets about the magician's knights, wounding and killing them. Klingsor makes the tower vanish, replacing it with a magic garden, and beautiful flower maidens rush in from all sides, urging Parsifal to play with them, promising him love as they dance around him, but he rebuffs them, until, as he turns to leave, Kundry calls his name, Parsifal. It's the first time we've heard it in the opera. He's rooted to the spot, remembering a dream in which his mother called him by the name. Kundry, transformed now into an enchanting beauty, names him Parsifal, innocent fool, and tells him how he broke his mother's heart, leaving her as he roamed afar while she died alone. For the first time, Parsifal feels something close to guilt, as Kundry offers him a kiss as a token of a mother's blessing. Although, as Wagner's music tells us, it turns out to be a far from maternal embrace, an extraordinary pivotal moment, as our Parsifal, Lars Klevermann, feels keenly.
Yeah, it's really strange, actually, when you look at it. I mean, she becomes first like a vision of his mother, and then she becomes a real woman to him when she kisses him. And in the kiss, she wakes his compassion and manhood and understanding of what he has to do, what is his task. So she is many different things, Kundry, really, for Parsifal, but really the one that wakes him up.
Well, Parsifal breaks free from Kundry with a cry of Amfortas, pressing his hands to his chest as if in agony. He feels the pain of the old knight's wound burning within him. He sensed in Kundry's embrace the power that ensnared Amfortas, and he rejects her. It's the turning point for Parsifal as he identifies with Amfortas's suffering and begins to feel compassion. Her astonishment gives way to admiration, and Kundry urges Parsifal to throw off the spell that seized him, but he thrusts her away. And she begs him to feel compassion for her too, to save her from her cursed existence. Parsifal realizes that he's been sent for Kundry's salvation as well and offers redemption for her sin if she'll lead him to Amfortas, but she refuses furiously and calls for the sacred spear that gave Amfortas his wound. Klingsor appears on the castle ramparts and hurls the spear at Parsifal, but it hovers in midair over the young man's head. Parsifal takes the sacred spear and with it draws the sign of the cross, the symbol that's going to wreak havoc on Klingsor's kingdom. Well, the Halle back on stage now. They've just tuned, led by Lynn Fletcher this evening. And here once again comes the Halle's music director, Sir Mark Elder, for the second act of Wagner's Parsifal here at the BBC Proms. Gazing into a mirror in the tower of his enchanted castle, Klingsor sees the figure of Parsifal approaching from afar, and he summons Kundry to seduce him.
erschloss den Toren, den kindisch jauchzend, wenn ich nahen seh. Triffst du dich wieder umher? Weh, dort einem Ritter gesinnt, wo wie ein Fee du dich halten lässt. Gefällt dir es bei mir nicht besser, als ihrem Meister du mir gefangen? Haha, den reinen Hüter des Grades. Was jagte dich da wieder fort?
Tiefe Nacht.
Ha, befiel dir Fuhle, sei. Versuch mit den Knaben der Nacht.
schlecht, wenn ich auch schön, denk euch das recht.
So willst du uns von schön, willst uns nicht schön.
Das möcht ich nicht.
Thank you.
euch schreiten.
Ich streite nun und
er schreit
von ihm.
Oh! wo irrtest du hin, hier vergessen? Alles vergaß ich wohl noch. Es war ich eh noch ein Gelenk. Du dumpfe Torheit lebt in mir.
Bekenntnis wird
Thank you.
Oh! diesen, der ihm so friedlos lachte, die Liebe, dazu suchte sie ihn. So neigte sich den Nacken, so hob sich Kinas Haut. So flatterte der Lachen in Lücken, so schlang um den Hals die Arm, so schmeichelte weich die Wange mit allem schwarzen Qual im Munde, lass einen schwelen, bis er ihn verwundt. Ah, dieser Kuss,
oh! kennt ihn klar und hell des einz'gen Heiles wahren Quell. Willend alle Rettung flucht, wubelten man zum Nacken in höchster Meines Heißes.
You've just heard the sound of Klingsor's castle disappearing in an earthquake as the magical garden withers to a desert. And as he sets off to find Amfortas, Parsifal turned to Kundry, "You know where you can find me again," he told her as he hurried away. The end of the second act of Wagner's final opera, Parsifal, here at the BBC Proms. And those cheers for Katarina de Lyman, the Swedish soprano, singing the part of Kundry here this evening. Warmly embraced by Sir Mark Elder, conducting the Halle Orchestra. The Flower Maidens back on stage. Parsifal joins them. Those cheers for our Parsifal. Lars Klebermann and the Halle Orchestra standing now, as are the women of the chorus of the Royal Opera at the back of the stage. And a fantastically malevolent Klingsor, Tom Fox, shaking the hand of Mark Elder. The Flower Maidens, Elizabeth Prag, Anita Watson, Sarah Castle, Anna James, Anna Devin, and Madeline Shaw. And by the way, I can tell you that Wagner's favourite scene in Parsifal was apparently the song of the Flower Maidens. He was known to turn up at Bayreuth just to hear that part of the opera, and that huge cheer from the audience here in the Royal Albert Hall was, again, for Katarina de Lyman. And one for Lars Klebermann, and also for Tom Fox. Now, cheers for the very colourfully attired Flower Maidens. Mark Elder and all our soloists bowing again. Well, you've just heard her in thrilling form. I'm really hoping that this evening's Kundry, Katarina de Lyman, will have time to join me live later on in this second interval to offer some insights into her pivotal character in Parsifal. But as everyone leaves the platform to begin this second interval, the historian and writer Leslie Chamberlain takes us from the Royal Albert Hall, south over the River Thames, to explore more of the German London made by Prince Albert.
The Great Exhibition in the summer of 1851 celebrated Britain's position in the middle of the 19th century as the world's leading manufacturing power. It took place in a vast greenhouse in Hyde Park. It ran from May to mid-October, and its chief organiser was Henry Cole, a top-flight civil servant. Cole was famous for having designed a classic tea service. More importantly, on his travels, he had seen a smaller-scale French equivalent, Exposition, in Paris in 1849. Without Cole, then, no show on the road. But the man who really made the Great Exhibition happen was Albert, the Prince Consort. Cole won over potential participants with a whisper. Prince Albert is behind this. British manufacturers rushed to display their products on the site, 1,848 feet long by 408 feet wide, available in the centre of London. I make that more than 10 Olympic-sized swimming pools, and half of it was reserved for them alone. The other half was given over to the achievements of foreign countries, from America to India, Russia to Switzerland. It was stunning what mankind, a word much in vogue at the time, had achieved. Thirst for information, faith in commerce and industry, inventiveness and technical daring, energy and tenacity, and a tendency to mix up religion with visible success. All these qualities have to be remembered as one embarks on a conducted tour of some of the exhibition of 1851, wrote the architectural historian Nicolaus Pevsner 100 years later. One of the items he picked out in his book High Victorian Design was a vase crowned by a statuette of the prince, with the scientist Isaac Newton, the philosopher Francis Bacon, Shakespeare and James Watt, inventor of the steam engine, occupying the next tier down, and the whole standing for the triumph of science. Certainly, it was by having that faith in commerce and industry, and being able to link it to religion and art, that Albert left his lasting legacy. But what did this grand optimism really feel like? Albert had a passion for cultural progress through material inventiveness. If you take a moment to look at the various Albert memorials dotted about the country, the one in London just across from the Albert Hall, you can see his interests clearly depicted. Commerce and engineering are there, but also music and architecture and philosophy. Born as Prince Albert of Saxe-Coburg and Gotha, his apparently typical German thoroughness and rigour made the average lightweight Englishman sigh, though apparently he was never ridiculed. And just as well, for Albert's knowledge of culture and his faith in its improving power were remarkable. He brought high culture into contact with a land obsessed with money-making and persuaded it to change. In particular, Albert, a German romantic in important aspects of his personality, changed life in London. He transformed North London's South Kensington, as is well known. His role in South London's Crystal Palace, which is less well known, is my story here. What kind of building could house an event of such magnitude as the 1851 extravaganza became? It had to be easy to erect, and as nearby Mayfair residents insisted, easy to take down. No one was going to build permanently on Hyde Park. Step forward landscape designer Joseph Paxton, who, familiar with greenhouses, made a doodle on the back of an envelope. What Paxton built, the great critic John Ruskin dismissed instantly as a cucumber frame between two chimneys. But others were less harsh. It was a people's palace. It was a sublime museum of present-day achievement. You could be snobbish about that if you were the poet William Makepeace Thackeray, but if you were a Pevsner newly arrived from Germany 100 years later, you could detect in the Crystal Palace a modernness, even a modernism, that first showed itself in England, before Germany and America took over the architectural initiative. Here, truly, Britain stood for progress, with a light-filled, lightweight, easily assembled architecture, more typical of the 20th than the 19th century. In the mercantile side chapels that led off its central nave, Paxton's transparent cathedral showcased everything from fancy beds and birdcages to the last word in factory machinery. On the altar of what the satirical magazine Punch instantly hailed the Crystal Palace, the age of the modern industrial consumer was crowned. But it's really what Albert proposed to do with the unexpected huge profit from the show that interests me. In South Kensington, he envisioned a complex of museums and institutions to educate the nation in music, art, science and design. He wanted to showcase and explain all the things, from the sublime to the most practical, that mattered to him as a curious and diligent mind. The Victoria and Albert Museum, the Natural History Museum, the Science Museum and the Royal College of Music stand today at the heart of what became known as Albertopolis. This was not just a project to improve the quality of the leisure time of the middle classes. Albert's concern was also to relieve the misery of the working class, which all this wealth building since the Industrial Revolution had created. The very title in full of the exhibition of the works of the industry of all nations surely contains a hint of an answer to Karl Marx's Workers of the World Unite, proclaimed just 3 years before. If you look at the Albert Memorial in Edinburgh, you'll see indeed that for Scots, it was Albert's efforts on behalf of the labouring classes that mattered more than his work in the arts. As Albert's biographer of 50 years ago observed, the prince sought a moral justification for his own sensual enjoyment of painting and music by striving to spread the same enjoyment throughout the classes. He felt that the dinginess of men's homes, the squalor of their work, the ugliness of their manufactured products could all be relieved and dignified by familiarising them with things of beauty. Wonderful. We could do with him back today. By 1854, the Crystal Palace, with extraordinary speed, had been flat-packed and re-erected in the green fields of Sydenham. Norwood Heights was what was written on the relief maps. Many would say the actual location was Penge, but whatever the future postcode, the sloping site was stunning, with fresh air and views for miles out over Kent. It is, for me, still one of those unmissable edge-of-London experiences when you can be quite sure the urban Wen is healing and true nature is once again in prospect. The building, while it was still there, was like a great glass Versailles presiding over the terraced formal gardens that fell away at its feet into the verdant distance. The area immediately took off as a desirable place to live, as well as visit on day excursions. Crystal Palace got a railway line, with a dedicated station of some grandeur, and five others round about. The transferred Crystal Palace became a venue for everything from flower shows to dog races, but above all it became a concert venue. A resident orchestra was formed to play in what became its concert arena, and soon it was offering a full programme every Saturday, and festivals in addition. It was an Albert Hall existing south of the river, a good 15 years before its future rival was conceived. The name of Albert is attached to the later building in memoriam, but the actual spirit of Albert seems to hover over all that is remembered of the musical life that took root in Penge. I can't prove a direct connection, but Albert, who loved Beethoven and Schubert and all that was sublime about German music in the early 19th century, was appalled when he first arrived at Buckingham Palace to find that his wife's orchestra was only a brass band, unable to play symphonies. Enter a talented coven of string players and the conductors to meld their sweet sounds with the horns and the woodwinds and the timps, and with the reformed Royal Orchestra, symphonic music in London was poised to take off. We were a Philistine lot in the first half of the 19th century, as those who strove so hard to pull us out of our utilitarianism kept reminding us. The writer Thomas Carlyle, the philosopher John Stuart Mill, Ruskin again, and William Morris, the man who changed our attitude to furnishings and brought beauty into the midst of domestic life, kept shaking their heads at the poor taste that was our national trademark. They taught us it wasn't right to put business before the artistic life. Art was an essential part of living, however you earned your daily bread. Our best critics had read the German Romantics on aesthetic education, and in that respect, the Romantic Albert was one of them. He shared the desires of Ruskin and Morris for social reform, inseparable from a life in which art mattered. It was Albert's achievement to get this quest to improve the nation recognised by government, and that happened exactly over the refounding of the Crystal Palace in South London. The Crystal Palace Company was a private company, and it was in deference to Albert that the then Prime Minister Lord Derby required it to preserve the high moral and educational tone which they had shown in giving practical effect to their magnificent scheme. In fact, the Crystal Palace became a much more enjoyable attempt to raise the nation's cultural niveau than did the heavy didacticism of the north of the river Albertopolis. Perhaps because it was out of the official eye. Perhaps because its quasi-modernist architecture inspired something more than perpetuating the imperialist dream. It seems to have been a joy. Think of that people's palace made of glass as like the South Bank today, with Albert as the equivalent of Minister for the Arts. In fact, since 1841, he had been chairman of the Royal Commission on the Fine Arts. And then remember the young German prince who arrived in this country, aged only 20, at the side of the Queen, his cousin. He wanted a culture to live in, so he began to change music and buildings where he could. Dissatisfied with the cold vastness of Buckingham Palace and the formalities of Windsor, he quickly won Victoria over to having a house of more humane dimensions built in lush countryside on the Isle of Wight. There is a nice consistency about his building of Osborne, where he was blissfully happy, and some of the earliest social housing in London he pioneered to take people out of slums. First built opposite the Hyde Park Crystal Palace, quasi as part of the exhibition, Albert's mansions were then moved to beside Battersea Park, where they still stand. One might say that Albert was trying to do also for all of us through his enterprises in architecture and music, what he first did for his wife. What Nikolaus Pevsner called the Coburg period, and I think it took a German to see some of the connections that others had missed, became then the history of England's aesthetic and social development, as it was found by Albert in 1840, and how it developed right up to the First World War, with special regard to the built environment. During the Second World War, Pevsner, a scholar from Dresden, who arrived as a refugee from Hitler, walked round and round London, trying to inspire the English to understand who they were. Fabulous modernisers, pioneer modernists even, on the one hand, and crass eclecticists on the other, ready to stick any style with any other and add tasteless twiddly bits, while putting up with a vast gap in amenities and aesthetic satisfaction between rich and poor. Albert, who had tried to distill the higher qualities of the muddled aesthetic life he put on show in 1851 and to provide inspiration for a more cultured future, was one of Pevsner's heroes. Albert deserved the accolade. Take the enjoyment of paintings nationwide. After the Great Exhibition, which generated an appetite for exhibition visits, Birmingham City Council complained directly to the Prince that it owned only one painting of a dead deer and that it would dearly like to expand its aesthetic horizons. Manchester also wrote to the Prince and as a result received much assistance in staging its Arts Treasures exhibition in 1857. Albert, both through his culture and his royal status, became a prime conduit for state patronage. There was nothing affected about Albert's love of the arts. For him and his wife, Mendelssohn, composer of that stunning octet at the age of 16 and six fabulous string quartets and four delightful symphonies, was also a friend with whom they made music at Windsor. Both the Queen and her husband sang, and Albert played the organ. Mendelssohn was one of the most prominent and well-liked German émigrés who came to live in London in Albert's time. And when he died, aged only 38, in 1847, the shock was enormous. Victoria later commissioned a bronze statue to stand at the Crystal Palace to commemorate Mendelssohn's role on the English music scene. Early music was another of Albert's causes, but the composer to whom he really gave an English following was Wagner, whose opera Lohengrin was first heard on this side of the Channel in the confines of Windsor Castle. Is it to Albert that we owe the beginnings of our great passion for Wagner, which at every performance of the Ring Cycle at the Opera House, the Colosseum, the Albert Hall and theatres across the country causes half-mile tailbacks of those in search of last-minute tickets? I like to think it was, in great part, Albert's doing, that in music many of us are more in love with Teutonic opera than the denizens of Wotan's own homeland, from those early days in which his influence on Crystal Palace programming caused a 2,000-strong choir to sing the Act III battle scene from Rienzi under the glass roof. It was at the Crystal Palace with its resident orchestra that German music began to change our lives. For decades, our main musical fare was restricted to Handel, Haydn, and a little Mozart. Albert, with his own tastes, helped us to something more. The first musical director of the Crystal Palace was a step backwards. He was a German, but a former military brass band leader, Heinrich Schellens, who turned out to be rather unscrupulous. It was his successor, August Friedrich Manz, who became the patron saint of the new era. When Manz was assistant to Schellens, his boss took the credit for a composition of Manz. Manz complained and was dismissed, but was reinstated and Schellens sacked by Sir George Grove, the future editor of the greatest musical encyclopedia in English, and at the time, secretary to the Crystal Palace Company. Manz's reign as the Crystal Palace's music director from his appointment in 1855 through to the knighthood bestowed on him by Albert's son in 1903 was a triumph, despite a certain critic called George Bernard Shaw sniping from the sidelines. A naturalised Englishman and part of the local German community that grew from year to year with what the Crystal Palace achieved, Manz inspired not only Grove, but also Sir Henry Wood, who would still be conducting there when, in 1895, he founded the Proms. The Crystal Palace Orchestra gave regular Saturday concerts in the grand, parlour palm garlanded surroundings of Sydenham's glass-walled People's Palace for over 40 years, until towards the end of the century it was disbanded because of financial pressures. The German maestro Hans Richter filled the eccentric space above all with renderings of Wagner, and now the inimitable mature work, replete with the religion of art with a capital A. Musical life continued with a non-resident orchestra until the palace was destroyed by fire in 1936. A disaster, but not an end, for arguably Albert's twin legacies to London were in fact finally brought together again when, with the tradition wood-founded, the great musical festivals of the pre-war Crystal Palace were finally transferred to the Albert Hall in 1941. It's there in our history, from the Coburg Hotel to the Bechstein Hall, the importance of the moment when classical German music became assimilated to the British idea of civilization. In music, above all, German romantic high-mindedness was a revelation and first caused the nation of shopkeepers to open its minds and hearts, such that former Prime Minister Arthur Balfour, in 1922, said that if the music of Germany were destroyed, we could not get on. Not the music, but much of the friendship and the German émigré colonies were sacrificed to two wars, when the Coburg became the Connaught and the Bechstein the Wigmore Hall. Looking back, it's salutary to remember Albert's achievement. It was in response to Albert that the British government first recognised that in the nation's progress, which it had hitherto measured only commercially, art, the arts if you like, but the grand idea of art is much better, art mattered. When Albert died tragically young in 1861, he was 42, it was not so much that his great project foundered as, inevitably perhaps, without his personal input, the high-minded idea of a dedicated cultural polis in one part of London lost its shine. The site is covered with a sad jumble of museums and institutions, in an area where much is dim and all is ugly. They are perhaps not out of place, but they should not be regarded as indicative of the Prince's ideals or of his aspirations for an enlightened public taste. This was South Kensington in 1949, according to one sad viewer. Happily, something has been done quite recently about that dim jumble. In 2011, on the 150th anniversary of the Great Exhibition, Albertopolis, for so long dismissed as a centralising Teutonic fantasy by London planners, finally re-emerged, newly united, through the near banishment of road traffic. It's true that the business interest can't be suppressed. Last time I was there, you could hardly take in the built environment for the fairground weave of stalls and caravans selling ever more food. But that's English culture for you. Next time you stroll up Exhibition Road from South Kensington, you might want to thank the Prince of Saxe-Coburg and Gotha for what he brought to London, and then hop on a train and find the traces of what he left behind in Crystal Palace too, as he brought his German high culture into our British midst.
The Albertopolis of the South was written and presented by Leslie Chamberlain and produced in Bristol by Tim Dee. And the German high culture in our British midst this evening at the BBC Proms is Wagner's final operatic epic, Parsifal. I'm Andrew McGregor, live here on BBC Radio 3. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall, where conductor Sir Mark Elder and the Halle and the rest of this huge cast are preparing to bring us the redemptive third act of Wagner's vision. And I'll also be hoping to grab a word with some of the promenaders for whom this Wagner season at the BBC Proms has become something of a ritual pilgrimage, I think it's fair to say. Well, as we heard in the second act of Parsifal, Kundry is the pivotal figure, the seductress who wakes in Parsifal the feelings of guilt and compassion that are going to bring the redemption needed to save the Fellowship of the Knights of the Holy Grail in Act 3. An act in which Kundry has comparatively little to do, so I'm delighted to say that means that this evening's Kundry soprano Katharina Dalaiman has been able to join me here in the presentation box. I'm no longer wearing the beautifully shimmering dress that you were wearing in the seduction scene, but looking very stylish nonetheless. So what just happened, Katharina? Explain the Kundry's predicament in the scene we've just seen.
Well, what happened was not what she wanted to happen. The biggest problem for Kundry is that she's doomed. She's cursed because of 2,000 years ago she laughed at Jesus on the cross. And she's doomed to walk on earth. She's sleeping for like 50 years and then she comes back and so on. And the only thing she wants to do, I think, well, you can do it in many different ways, is to die or to get just a normal, regular life. She's cursed also to be in Klingsor's hands. So she's working both with the knights and Gornemans and also this other horrible work by Klingsor, trying to seduce men. And she didn't manage to do that now. As Klingsor said, the one who refuses you is going to save you. But she didn't really listen to that. I don't think she understood that in the beginning of the second act.
Because it's a little puzzling, isn't it? Because we know that she's trapped in this bind where she has to try to seduce people until someone turns her down. Someone says no. And they always disappoint her.
She has to do the work. She really has. It's not like she can't get a deal with this man. he has to refuse her by himself, and that's what he did.
But then then Parsifal offers Kundry redemption. Yes. And she turns it down. What happens?
Yeah, it's very strange, isn't it? But it's like she's brainwashed by Klingsor, and she has to do this thing, and she's like a machine. She just has to go through this.
He has to say no.
Yeah. Poor woman.
And the way Wagner treats Kundry in the third act seems a little bit cruel. She's served her purpose in Act Two, and she's sort of barely there. She's changed and. Everybody almost, after the beginning of the act, almost kind of pushes her aside. She's ignored by almost everything except the orchestra itself.
Yeah, but it depends on if you're doing it production. It depends on the director, what he wants from it. Because I love to act. So I really enjoy the third act, actually. And to be there, to listen, to do the things that says in the score. But it's also, in a way, very relaxing because you only have two words. You know that your singing is over and you can just concentrate on the acting. But of course I prefer productions when they bring out Kundry a little bit more instead of just being like a little slave. That I don't like.
Well, those are your words, aren't they? To serve.
Yeah.
To serve. And then there's lots of acting for you, as you say.
Yes.
But I suppose, in a way, I suppose Wagner's been quite kind to you, because after the extremes of the second act, I'm surprised you have any voice left.
You don't need to sing anymore, today at least. Yeah.
But what is the part like to sing for a Wagnerian of your experience?
It's the best. It's just wonderful. It suits my voice really well because it's very low and it's very high, but it's not lying in the high on the high tessitura all the time. It goes up and it goes down, and I love that. And it's compared to the other parts that Wagner wrote, it's quite short, but it's very intense. Same time in the second act.
And what's it been like singing it here at the BBC Proms in front of this audience?
Absolutely wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. The acoustic here is unbelievable. And it, no matter how you turn, it's always the same kind of sound. It goes round. It's fantastic.
Well, even from here, I could hear you coming back at us, no matter which way you were facing. It's an amazing sound, isn't it?
Yeah.
Katharina Dalaiman, thank you so much for coming in and spending some time with us here in the interval. We better allow you to get back because you do have plenty to do.
I have to be on stage at least.
Well, thank you very much indeed. And before we grapple with Wagner's resolution, I actually asked Mark Elder how Wagner achieves the transition from suffering and pain to the redemption that's the end of Parsifal's journey.
As so often in his great works, he does it through the way he uses harmony. How he delays harmonic resolution, how he colours melodies with unexpected harmonic shifts. And so the harmony sometimes is devoid of key. It's as if the solid earthing of musical utterance on a key, on a structure, whether it's B major, B flat major, C major, all that is up for grabs. It's as if there might not be a key. And unless something happens in this story to make things better, we may never find our home base again. And he's brilliantly clever at hinting at keys and then going away from them and dismantling them. And this means for the singers, it's very, very challenging because you have to have a keen ear to keep in pitch, to keep your line really focused and wait for the support of the orchestra. Much of the conversations and narratives happen with very, very few notes. This is the greatest opera that I know that has as many silences in it. Extraordinary number of bars marked to be completely silent. Nobody says anything, the orchestra don't play anything. And it's as if the timing of the breath of this opera has a peculiar, unusual stillness at its centre. And into the silence comes the next musical utterance, which I love because the greatest music must come from silence.
At the end of the opera, is everything resolved? As far as you're concerned, what do you think Wagner is leaving us with?
I think there has to be a feeling that the right form of leadership in any community or society must never allow itself to be too inward-looking. That in order to understand the best that we can experience in this life, we need to be careful to keep our antennae really listening and feeling, that we need to keep growing outwards, to keep curious and not to get turned in on our obsessions, on our human relationships. And that the figure of Parsifal at the end, having achieved such heroic leadership and having the personality to bring himself through the events of the opera, is a metaphor for maturity, for the need that we all should have to reach above ourselves, and that our ability to influence those around us and our own development should never be taken for granted.
This evening's conductor, Sir Mark Elder, and certainly not taking a moment of Parsifal for granted, I'm quite sure, are the Wagner fans who've been coming to every one of these Proms productions of his opera. You might have met them and heard their voices already on Radio 3 during Barenboim's Ring Cycle. They're here with me now, Scots Rock and Rollers, Al White and Sean Watson. Sadly, without new
without
best friend,
Helen.
What happened?
Without
Helen's
Helen.
Moved to Skipton.
She's moved. Yorkshire.
Unfortunately, so we'll be missing the rest of the process.
Wish her well.
Hi, Helen. Hope you're having a wonderful time.
Well, she's not here, but you've made it to the epic finale,
of
Wagner's
course.
Final opera.
Yeah, yeah.
How does it feel to be actually sitting here for this, or standing here for this, I should say, you're down in the arena, after the experience of all the other operas and the complete ring?
Fantastic. It's specifically this opera, it's so wonderful to see in such close connection with the others, because this is like the sequel and the summation of everything I think Wagner did, into which all you can see it, all the tropes, ideas, images are poured and made complicated and modern. And it's within that very, almost cloud of unknowing that he keeps you at this level of kind of meditation and then beats you with a stick of everything.
He
of
really
what it means
just
to
did
be
that
human.
In the second act,
I mean,
didn't he?
You were talking about that earlier, Sean, the stillness.
Yeah, the stillness. And I think seeing it in conjunction with the Ring Cycle especially, I think we said before when we saw the ring that it feels like something's being done to you. You're just everything's being thrown at you and you can only grasp a few things out of that. But when you see this, it's something you have to engage with properly and focus and meditate, and that's what I think I'm getting from this. It's a very different experience.
It's a place without time. I always think, after history's happened, that's when Parsifal takes place. And it's in that, but it's what we call our age, postmodernism. That Sean and I have grown up in the hell where there are Klingsors who want to make a magic castle without any work, where there are Gurmanances who historicize brutal Parsifals. And what do we do in that? the one thing this opera tells you too is it gives you the grail, and that's the music. That you can come here and drink it and listen to it, and if there's one thing in this world of confusion, that's what will keep you young. And it's a wonderful, wonderful thing.
Now, we've just heard in the background there your fellow promos giving their daily financial report, but I want one from you as well. How many hours, days queuing have you totted it up?
Oh, God, I wouldn't like to think. A couple of days in total, I guess. Yeah,
far too long.
Not too long. It's been a wonderful experience there. We have met so many exceptional people.
Oh, no, it's been fantastic. It has been truly festival-like.
You know, people, that's what I mean about staying young. The people who we've met who have been able, you know, they have this spark in their eye from listening to this stuff, because it re-centers you. You come back here and you realize this is what's real, this is what matters.
Yeah. And has it changed your view of Wagner from actually hearing it like this at the proms? A different kind of environment, not a house, and also very unusual hearing this range of Wagner operas over such a short space of time.
Yeah, as I was saying, I feel like each one is so different for different reasons, and to get the complete picture and to see it in this setting where, you know, you have to be focused, everyone's standing up at the front, I think this is the way it should be done, to be honest. It's like,
it's electrifying.
Yeah.
Well,
there's no point asking whether it's been worth it. Because that's quite obvious. But I have to ask, what's Monday morning going to feel like, knowing there's no more? I know it's a bank holiday.
Notting Hill Carnival.
The carnival,
it's
we're
amazing.
Going. We're
gonna, it's going to be
drown
absolutely
our
wonderful.
Sorrows and dance.
Dance
to,
with flower maidens. To West dance through life. Listen to music. It
that
will
sounds
be
like a brilliant solution, actually. Yeah. But how long are you going to leave it before you allow yourself to dip a toe into Wagner's heady world once again? Have you got plans?
We'll be back for the Covent Garden Parsifal, I think, in November.
Yeah, and anything else that comes along, if we can spot it. We try not to be too much of anorex nowadays and not just be so obsessed with taking in opera, but, you know, do something ourselves to make the world a better place.
Like, we're going to go and learn music properly, I think.
Yeah. And make a difference.
And one other thing, stress on the lower body. What's it been like standing?
It's better
down
to
in
stay.
The arena.
I'll say this
I think I'm fitter than I've ever been. They're going through this. It's really limbered me up.
Don't worry about standing. When you can get some of the best seats in opera houses around the world, you can get standing for no money. Don't worry about it. If you can, you can stand. It's fantastic.
Well, as a cyclist, maybe I should try it. Actually, it couldn't do me any harm. Look, Alan Shaw, thanks very much indeed
for
popping up. We'd better let you get back down below because you've got very little time to get
thank
back to your
so
seats.
Much.
So thanks very much for stopping by. And at the start of Parsifal's third act, it seems that some time has passed with no sign of Parsifal. It's a spring morning, and at the edge of the forest, Gunnamant, now a very old man, emerges from a hermit's hut. He's heard a groaning lament, and he finds Kundry almost lifeless in the thorn bushes by the hut. She comes round, pale and with all her former wildness gone, a penitent now. All she wants to do is serve. As Kundry fetches water from the spring, they see a figure clad entirely in black armour emerge from the forest holding a spear, his visor closed. Gurnemont chastises him for coming armed to such a hallowed place and on such a holy day. It's Good Friday. The knight thrusts the spear into the ground, removes his helmet, and kneels in silent prayer. Kundry and Gurnemont recognise him, Parsifal, and with him the sacred spear that once pierced the crucified Christ's side and in Klingsor's hands gave Amfortas his grievous wound. So what's happened to him? Where's he been? Here's our Parsifal, Lars Cleverman.
We see an older person. He has grown to become a man. Years have passed. And he has been through a lot between the second and the third act. Since he got the spear back, he's lost in the woods and tried to find his way. He is attacked, cannot use the weapon because it's sacred. So he's wounded, he's tired, and all this fighting has really wore him down. And in a way, he almost